Okay, it looks like we're ready to begin. My name is Brad Sullivan. I'm coming to you from Redmond, Washington, at Microsoft. And I'm a program manager on the Visual Studio team. More specifically, within the Visual Studio team, I work within the diagnostics group. And what the diagnostics group does is they create the set of tools that you use for your wide variety of applications that you develop in Visual Studio. Even more specifically than that, within the diagnostics team, I'm the program manager for the Visual Studio debugger. I spend all my days thinking about how we make debugging features and how we debug our different apps in our different scenarios. Okay, so today we're going to be talking about ASP.NET. More specifically, we're going to be talking about diagnosing issues in your ASP.NET applications in production using tools that come in Visual Studio 2012. First, we're going to talk a little bit about what challenges you see when you are diagnosing issues that happen in production. Then we're going to talk about four Visual Studio tools that you can use to help solve your issues. And those tools are the Remote Debugger, IntelliTrace, the Dump Debugger, and the Visual Studio Profiler. Lastly, we're going to talk about sources and symbols and how those are critical for making these scenarios work end to end. All right, so what challenges do you see when you are diagnosing an issue that's happening in production? Well, why are you diagnosing an issue that's happening in production is, I guess, the first thing to talk about. Well, usually you have to do this because you're seeing some issue, your customers are seeing some issue, you're losing revenue because you can't reproduce the issue in your development environment. So that forces you to try to figure out what's going wrong in the production environment and why are these different? It's usually not possible to run Visual Studio on a production machine. Maybe if you have a very special relationship with your operations team or something, they might let you do that. But for the most part, we're going to assume that you can't run Visual Studio. It's too big. It's too heavy. It does too much on that machine. You don't have the right permissions to do that on that machine. So instead, you'll be using smaller, more lightweight tools to do that initial investigation. You also want to minimize the impact to the server. So if you're running some diagnostic tool on the server, you don't suddenly want your performance to just drop off. You need to maintain some level of performance that your customers would expect, and keep your and maintain your server availability as well. So because of these things, you have to make the right trade-offs when you're choosing which diagnostic tool is going to be that you're going to be using to solve which problem. If you do have a problem where your site is down, then in that case you might not be that worried about slowing down the performance a little bit because everything is going wrong anyway. So that's not going to be your main issue. Finally, security. You want to make sure that you're not poking a whole bunch of holes in that production service as you're using tools on it to diagnose the issues. All right, so the first tool that I'm going to talk about is the Visual Studio Remote Debugger. I'm calling this the Big Hammer. Why is it the Big Hammer? Well, out of all the tools that I'm going to talk about, it's probably the most powerful, but it's also the most impactful. So the advantages of the Remote Debugger is that it's often the fastest way to resolve an issue. As a developer, You're used to using the capabilities within the Visual Studio Debugger every day while you're developing your code. And using the remote debugger is no different, right? It provides 100% of the capabilities that you use during your regular debugging. Another advantage is that it's Xcopy deployable. You might not know that, but if you go to where the remote debugger is installed on your VS machine, you can actually grab that directory for the appropriate process architecture and copy that over to any other machine, and then just launch MSVSmon, which is the remote debugger executable, without running an install. So it does have an advantage in production in being that sort of lightweight tool. It also has configurable authentication. So in terms of security, you can make sure that only the right people are going to be able to debug any process that's running on your remote machine. And the disadvantages are that if you're debugging, your service becomes unresponsive if you are stopped in the debugger. This could mean, you know, if you're stopped at a breakpoint, you're stopped in an exception. What happens is, you know, all threads in the process are going to be halted, and so you're going to have zero availability for that feature. So that's the trade-off. You use the big hammer when you want to solve the really hard problem and you need to solve it really soon, and you're not worried about it getting in the way of a few other users at the same time. It does also require some firewall configuration. So on your production service, you would need to poke an additional hole in the firewall to let Visual Studio talk to the remote debugger. All right, so how does the remote debugger work? Well, in Visual Studio 2012, we actually greatly simplified the way it works, we optimized it quite a bit. So it's simply on the client side, on your development machine, you just have Visual Studio. And on your server machine, you have the remote debugger, which is runs in the process msvsmon.exe. Visual Studio just communicates with msvsmon.exe over TCP/IP. And then msvsmon.exe is actually doing all the debugging on your app. So in Visual Studio 2012, we made a lot of upgrades to the remote debugger. It now has a single firewall configuration. And what that means is that in previous releases, you actually had to open up ports in the firewall on both your Visual Studio machine and the remote debugging machine. And that was kind of a pain. Now you only have to do it on the remote machine. In addition, when it's configuring the firewall, it actually detects the firewall configuration on startup. So if on startup it's not already configured correctly, the remote debugger will offer you a dialog with a single button that you can click, which will configure the firewall. It can now connect across different domains. In earlier versions of Visual Studio, you had to let's say you had a domain where you had all of your regular employees where they were just doing their day-to-day development, and then you, on your network, and then you had a separate domain where you had your servers, and as in the case in many environments. In earlier versions of Visual Studio, the remote debugger would not work across the domains, but that has been fixed in Visual Studio 2012, and so now it will. Also importantly, symbols now load from the Visual Studio side. So this is pretty important in production. In earlier releases, you would have to, along with deploying your binaries, you would have to essentially deploy all of your symbols to the opposite side. And so Visual Studio could load them from there. That's no longer the case. So you don't need to pollute your production server with symbol files. Instead, you can just leave them on your where you normally get them on your development machine and read them from there. It's faster. When we completely refactored the remote debugger, we got significant performance gains. So if you had problems before with slow stepping over remote, those have been solved. And there's also no need to choose between x86 and x64. In earlier releases, what you would need to do is actually, if you had an x64 machine, which if you're running servers, I'm sure you do, you would have to install two copies of the remote debugger, and then you would need to remember which one to run and which one to connect to, depending on what type of app you wanted to debug. In the Visual Studio 2012, all you need to do is, if you're on an x64 machine, is download the x64 version. And what it will do is when you launch the 64-bit version, it will automatically know if you are trying to debug a 32-bit app. And it will launch another copy of itself behind the scenes to debug the 32-bit app, and you don't have to worry about it. It just works. So to show you really quick. Oops. One of the things that I mentioned. So while we did some major changes to the remote debugger, the UI actually looks exactly the same as it has in previous releases. So this is just what it looks like from the monitoring side. I mentioned that it has configurable permissions so that you can decide who you want to allow to remotely debug. Additionally, you might notice that you can turn off authentication mode. In earlier releases, that was something that people did quite often because it was really hard to get the connection working otherwise. There's really no good reason to do that anymore. The Windows authentication works great. In fact, if you have, if you're not authenticated, but you are actually that user and you do know the credentials, for a user who is able to use the remote debugger on that machine, it will actually prompt you for those credentials so that you can type them in and then just connect to the remote debugger. Targeting the remote debugger is really straightforward. Before, there was a little bit of fanciness in the strings that you had to use, but today, all you need to do is put the machine name and optionally the port. The default port is 4016. If you don't specify the port, that's the one it will automatically use. And then you can see that I am connected to this remote debugger. So there's no special syntax. If you are on a network that doesn't have a DNS that's going to resolve a machine name, you can also just type in an IP address, and that will work as well. Okay. So we're going to move on from the remote debugger, which is sort of the more heavyweight tool, and we're going to talk a little bit about IntelliTrace. So what is IntelliTrace? Well, it's sort of like a debugger, but it's more like a back-in-time debugger. So what it does is it logs the state of an application through its execution history and then gives you a log that you can then debug. So when you're debugging that, you're right in the Visual Studio debugging UI, but you have the ability to move back and forth and to see what types of events have occurred throughout time. You can do this locally in Visual Studio, so if you just if you have Visual Studio Ultimate and you hit F5 on a managed application, you're going to get an IntelliTrace window that's going to show you all those events. But we're talking about production today, so You can actually also run it just from a command line. So you can turn on that logging and run it that through the command line and run it that way. So there's a few steps to this. Essentially, the first thing that you do is you download the IntelliTrace collector. So the IntelliTrace collector is it's available separately from Visual Studio. It's completely free. And you can run it anywhere you want. So then you move that to your production machine. You pick a collection plan. I'll talk a little bit more about collection plans later. But essentially, a collection plan is the dial for how much information you want to collect while you're analyzing the application. Target the application. Reproduce the issue that your customers are seeing, or have the user reproduce the issue that they are seeing, and then you bring the IntelliTrace log back to your development machine, open it in Visual Studio, and begin your analysis to find the bug. So, before I talk a little bit more about collection plans, I'm actually going to demonstrate doing exactly that. All right. Close that, actually. All right, so let's say that I have a website. Oops. This website is called Fabricam Fiber. And so this is giving me a view of support tickets. So I'm logged in as a user. And I'm looking at these reports that people are saying of things that are going wrong. And as I look through this, oops, I click on this one. It says there's an error while retrieving data from the server. Great. So now I have my bug. So this is the bug that we are going to try to figure out using IntelliTrace. So the first thing you do is you want to install IntelliTrace onto your machine. So IntelliTrace comes as an install pack. Well, why does it come in as an install pack? Well, this is all it does. It pops a EULA, a license agreement. So once you run the installer, all this does is gets you to accept the agreement and then drops a CAB file. So the CAB file is actually what you need. So once you have that CAB file, you only need to do this once. Then you can move that CAB file to any of your production machines that you want. So it is truly a install free once you get past that. Okay. So running IntelliTrace from a command line is done through PowerShell. So the first thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to import the PowerShell module that comes from that CAB file. Okay, so I've done that. So now that I've imported that, I'm just going to take a quick look at what commands are now available to me. Okay, so it looks like I have a few commands there. I can start IntelliTrace collection. That's good. I can stop it. That's also good. There's a command for checkpointing. So what checkpointing is it's essentially a way to get that log, but to continue collection. And then I have different ways to get statuses or get info about the files that I've collected. Okay. So what do I want to do in my case? I want to actually just start collection. So I'm going to go ahead and do that. And I just do that by running the start collection command. Then I am pointing it at my app pool that's running. Then I am telling it which collection plan that I want to use. And in this case, I've chose this ASP.NET Trace XML. The collection plans come as XML. And then you you give it a location to write the log file. Once you have decided to start collection, you then just need to confirm. Okay, now IntelliTrace is running. So what do? Well, I just need to reproduce the issue. So I think I remember how to do that. Just open Internet Explorer. Apologize for the strange display here. It was better than the screen just going up and down over and over again, though. Okay. Yep, there it goes. Now I just click on this one. Okay, and there. Now I've reproduced this error. So let's see what I can get from my IntelliTrace log. All right, let's make sure that this thing has been working okay. So I'm just going to run this command to check the status. Okay, that status seems fine, and it's telling me that it does have that output path, so I can see which file I am writing to. That's good. So now I'm just going to finally stop collection. And once again, I need to confirm that I'm going to stop collection. All right. So now I should have access. This is my file location. And this is the one that was created now. Yes, it's 4:38 a.m. on this machine. It is on Seattle time. Okay, so what happens when I open this in Visual Studio? Well, the first thing that happens is I go to the IntelliTrace summary page. And what this summary page it does is it gives me just a high-level overview of the most important information for this trace. So for example, it's telling me all the exceptions that have occurred. You can see that some of these exceptions seem to be happening a few times. And that's due to the nature of the catch rethrow. So that's why they appear multiple times. When you select an exception, it will show you the call stack, so you get some quick context. But really, if you want to dig into more information, what you do is you click the Start Debugging button. Oops. Sorry, having some focus issues here. There we go. So there's a hidden scroll bar that I needed to grab. So I'm going to choose this null reference exception because that one actually seems interesting. It seems like it might be the root cause of my problem. So I'm going to start debugging, and what that's going to do is. It's going to actually start the debugging process where you can get that real debugger UI integration, but it's going to do it in the context of that exception that I selected. So I can still get to those other events that I was seeing. So now you can see on this right-hand panel here that there's a bunch of other contexts that I can jump to as well. Additionally, I can use this little UI in the gutter, and I can sort of step backwards, and I can see what the different local variables were at those different times. But in this case, I'm going to go back to where it brought me, right to where that exception was, and I'm going to see why this was a null reference exception. Well, I think that I have figured out why that is. If I look at the value of assigned to here, it says assigned to equals null. But then I can see that in my code, I am using assigned to dot full name. So that's got to be the null reference exception there. So now I know how to fix that, and I can take that back to my development side and add a null reference check or do something downstream to make sure that I'm not going to end up with a null value there. All right, so IntelliTrace collection plans. So you saw me choose one, and I chose trace. And trace is essentially equivalent to what we call events. So there's two default levels in Visual Studio. There's calls and events. The calls level is also sometimes referred to as IntelliTrace High. It's essentially logging like every call that you're going to make. Events just takes specific events. There's like ASP.NET events. There's exceptions. There's UI events like button click or something like that, and uses those as checkpoints as to where to do a collection. So if you were to go back into VS. So let's say you went to Tools Options, IntelliTrace. There you go. So these are here you can see what the events are, and there's different events for specific app types as well. So you can see that there's ASP.NET events, and all of those are checked. So that's how you configure it through the UI, but that's really applicable if you wanted to, for example, do F5 debugging. But what about in production? Well, I gave it an XML file, so if I wanted to customize that, I would need to edit the XML. So I can do that if I really want to. If I were to do that, I'd be able to turn off individual events or turn on individual events. I can include and exclude modules, so that if one of those events is occurring in code that I don't care about because it's noisy, then I can turn that off. For example, by default, IntelliTrace already does that for some CLR DLLs. And I can also change the max size of the log if I want to restrain that more, or if I don't care and I want it to write out more data, I can change that. So to get it to change that, like I said, you have to edit some XML. It's a little bit intimidating. But if you go through it, you can find where the events are and turn them on. There's a bit more information about how to do that online. Okay. So what is the impact of IntelliTrace on server performance? Well, the answer is, unfortunately, it depends. So it depends on a number of factors, like the number of events that you're collecting, what you have on, and how many of those events that your application is throwing. The number of modules included in the application also has an impact. These do get jitted because IntelliTrace is essentially a profiler. And so you're going to have some startup costs on that. The calls data collection, depending on if you have an app that makes just a lot of function calls, maybe it's highly recursive, then you're going to that's going to slow you down, and also your I/O speed, so how much it's writing to that log file, is going to have an impact on the performance. So because it depends, because it's variable, it's a good thing to try out like on your staging machine or on a test machine. And look at what the performance is like for typical actions before turning it on. But for a lot of apps, it's really, really not impactful. All right, so I showed you how to do this IntelliTrace in production from a command line, but it can actually get a little easier than that. So if you have System Center, and you have System Center 2012 with SP1, Operations Manager, there's IntelliTrace integrated right into that. So what that means is two things, really. So the application performance monitoring that's part of System Center is now, that information is now available in an IntelliTrace format. So you can pull those logs over into Visual Studio and analyze them through the IntelliTrace UI. In addition, you can actually use the IntelliTrace profiling management pack to collect IntelliTrace logs directly from the Operations Manager console. So you don't have to do quite as much tinkering around. So it's fully integrated in there. You cannot do both of these at once, unfortunately, since both application performance monitoring and IntelliTrace are both CLR profilers. The CLR will only allow one of them to work at once. So you can, for example, keep APM on for long term, and then if you find that there's a harder problem that you can't find with that level of data, then you can turn on IntelliTrace and get more data to solve that problem. Okay. So the next tool that I want to talk about is dump debugging. So what are dump files? Dump files are snapshots of the application at a single point in time. So as opposed to IntelliTrace, which is sort of lighter snapshots across time, this is one bigger snapshot at a single point. There's two major types of dumps. There's dumps with heap, and those allow full inspection of the state of the application at that point in time. And there's dumps without heap, which only allows for inspection of the call stacks across all threads. There's actually several other flags involved with dump creation, but for the most part, those are the two types that you need to be concerned about. So you can open dumps directly in VS and debug them, just like a regular application, and you get all that all the VS debugging functionality, except, of course, there's no execution control because it's a single point in time, so you can't step a dump in either direction. So there's a lot of tools out there for creating dump files. For example, Visual Studio can create dump files, but that's not necessarily the best tool for you in production. So what I'm actually going to recommend here is a tool called ProcDump, which has a lot of qualities that make it a really good tool for collecting dumps. One, it's a command line tool, so it can be really easy to use in production. Two, it is Xcopy deployable. It's downloadable as a zip file that you can just move around really easy. And even without it being zipped, it's really small, so it's easy to move around onto different machines. It provides a lot of triggers for dump collection. So for example, you can trigger on CPU usage. If your CPU ticks above 50%, say, you can make it automatically start to collect dumps. You can trigger it on memory usage. If your memory footprint jumps above a certain level, you can make it automatically collect a dump. And you can trigger it on exceptions, and that's both first-chance exceptions and unhandled exceptions, and apply filters on top of that so that you can get big, meaty snapshots that you can debug when your app is throwing exceptions. It has a low impact on the system performance, lower than other tools that do dump collection. And that's because it uses special technology that allows it to continue to write the dump while the app is still executing. It's available through Microsoft System Terminals, and I added a download link to the slides if you wanted to use it. So I'm going to quickly show using ProcDump. So I have a command line here. And what I'm going to do is first, I'm going to make sure I'm not still running my web server. I am not. That's good. So I am going to start my web server. Oops, I did not get that whole string. Okay, let's get that started. All right, so my web server is now started. So let's check this out. All right, so in this case I have an app, which is a store that sells toy airplanes. So I'm going to click around on this app. If I click one of these, I see an error. Okay, so I'm going to go back. All right, so the first thing I'm going to do is I am going to start proc dump with this command line here. So what does this command line do? Well, there's a few things that I've configured it to do. One, I'm saying I have this flag MA. That means I want a full dump with heap. Then I have an E flag with a 1. That means that I want to create a dump on exceptions, and the 1 means include first chance exceptions. And then I'm applying a filter with this F flag, and my filter is garbage right now, and that's intentional. I'm just I'm giving it garbage so that I can show what it does when it's just logging. And then I give it my app, which is just my web server, and where I want the where I want it to write the dump file. So what happens if I run that? Okay, so it started monitoring. When I click on this guy here, I can see, oh. So even when it's not when it's not actually writing out the dump, if it's seeing the exceptions, it'll print them out for you. So you can use that to your advantage if you want. And now what I'm going to do is I'm just going to run that same command, but I'm going to change the filter. Instead of this garbage ASDF filter, I'm going to say if the exception contains the word access, which I need to spell correctly, then write the dump. Okay, so it's doing that. I click on this. All right, so it wrote the dump, and then it exited. Good. So I had it write it to my desktop. So let's go there. Here it is. So to open a dump file, all I need to do is just double-click on it, and it will open in Visual Studio. So this gives me this takes me to the dump summary page, and what the dump summary page does it gives me a summary of the dump. You know, it gives me the process architecture, which version of the CLR I'm using, which modules have been loaded as a searchable list. Then it gives me a set of action links. So what I can do from the action links is, for example, I can set my symbol paths. If I wanted to use Microsoft Symbol Servers, I'm not going to do that right now, so I'm going to turn that off. I can quickly do that, but if I know that this app is coming from somewhere where I needed to set a symbol path to a specific location, I can do that right from here. And then it also gives me entry points into debugging, so I have a choice. I can debug with mixed native and managed, or I can debug with just native. So since this is a ASP.NET app, I'm going to choose mixed so I can see what's going on in the managed code. And boom, it takes me to my exception message. So what does this exception message say? It says access to path clogs errors.txt is denied. So I can break in there. I can view my call stack. I can view my code. It takes me right to the line of code that is failing. So it's where I'm logging my product errors, ironically enough, is what's causing the error for me. So I can look at my local variables, so I can see the path that I'm trying to log to. And interestingly enough, what I can do is as well, even though there is no code executing, Visual Studio for managed dumps has the ability to execute some code as if the application is running. So that's pretty necessary in managed code because so many of the variables are properties that you need to retrieve. So you can run those getters essentially to do that. And just to show you that I can run something that does require code to run, I'm just going to append these two strings in the watch window. I need to spell that variable correctly though. There we go. Yep, and I can see that I've actually able to append them there. Okay. So the next tool after dump debugging that I want to talk about is the performance profiler. So the performance profiler essentially does five different types of things, and you can do these all in production. So you can do CPU sampling, which shows which parts of the application are executing the most frequently. You could do instrumentation, which records how long functions take to execute and how many times they are executed. So those two are essentially two different strategies. One's statistical for determining what's making your app slow from a CPU point of view. You can use .NET memory allocation, which tracks what objects are being allocated. Resource contention, which tracks for multi-threaded apps, which tracks when threads are contending for the same resources, and that's what's causing your slowdown. So you can get a view of when each thread is executing. And finally, tier interaction profiling, which is pretty helpful for production applications, because almost very few production applications are a single tier. So this records database queries that go through ADO.NET, and you can see how long those are taking as well. So the profiler can be run from the Visual Studio IDE, and it can also be run in production from the command line. If you want to run it in production, there's a standalone installer that comes with Visual Studio, and so you can just grab it from the VS install directory and install it on your production machine. The tier interaction profiling that I mentioned, that helps you find the performance bottlenecks caused by how your application is using the database. And interestingly, it can be used simultaneously with another profiling method, for example, instrumentation. And so I'm actually going to show you that right now. All right. So I'm going to go to my command prompt. And I'm going to shut down my web server, which is indeed still running. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to set some environment variables. And what these environment variables do, so this is VS Perf CLR ENV. So the first one essentially is telling the CLR that I'm going to be doing some profiling. And the second one, which is extremely similar, is just saying, oh, in addition to that, I'm going to be doing tier interaction profiling. So these are just two different VS Perf CLR ENV commands. So the CLR will read those when it is starting up, and it will configure itself in the right way so that this is possible. So that's essentially just a prerequisite. The next thing I'm going to do is, since I'm going to be doing instrumented profiling, I need to instrument the binaries that I want to profile. So I have a couple of those, and I think that they're actually still instrumented. Yes, there are. It doesn't support processing binaries. They're already instrumented. That's fine. That just means that I did that earlier. But you just run this just in case you had done a rebuild or anything before, since the last time you did this profiling. Okay. Finally, I want to turn the profiler on. And so I turn the profiler on using these VS Perf CMD commands. So I say start trace and output. I will call my output live demo.vsp. VSP are the profiler files. Okay, now it is on. So all I need to do now is to start my web server. So this is my command for starting my web server. There we go. For you, this might just be IIS reset or something like that. Okay. Now, I'm going to be just profiling this same app, this Tailspin Toys, that I was showing before. But I'm just trying to fix a problem with the app startup. So I'm waiting. Okay, there it goes. So the app startup was kind of slow. And so that's the problem I'm going to try to fix. So now that I've reproduced the issue with the profiler running, I'm just going to shut down my web server. And I am also just going to shut down my profiling. And I just do that with another VS Perf command. So I just do a VS Perf shutdown. There we go. All right. Now that has been officially shut down. So now what do I have? Okay. I have a VSP file that I just created. So where did I put that? I think I stored it here. I called it live demo. Yep, and there it is, 5:04 a.m. It's once again Seattle time. And you can see my previous attempts, final practice and final practice. Okay. So what happens when I open this VSP file? Well, first, it gives me a hot path view. So the hot path view is showing me, the path through my application that's using the most amount of time. So that's giving me a lot of hints of what's making this slow. Additionally, it's telling me which functions are doing the most individual work. So what's interesting is the leader with a whole lot of the elapsed time is this system.data.link.data.context call going on. So looks like I'm spending a lot of time in link. So that's sort of tipping me off that I'm going to switch away from this summary view, and instead I'm going to look at the tier interaction profiling that I was doing. So I switched to tier interactions. And what am I going to do? I'm going to expand this. This is my my list of database connections. So it looks like I made 7 queries. And if I look at the amount of time for the queries, one of those queries is completely dominating. So what is that? That is this get customer query. So okay, get customer. That might take a decent amount of time. Maybe my business is really successful and I have a lot of customers that I need to get. But the other thing I notice is that the query call is running twice. That doesn't seem that necessary to me. All I did was start up the app. Why do I need to get this twice? I could save a heck of a lot of time in the startup if I were only doing it once. So let's go back to the summary view, and let's dive into this function that's taking a lot of time. So I can see that when I select this function, I can see what function I am, but also what function it calls and what functions call it. So okay, let's look at select customer. Okay, and then we have get customer. All right. Let's take a look at these functions. All right, so I have this select customer, and that's getting called twice. All right, then what can I do? I can jump right into the source. From here I can see, this is the get customer query that was taking a lot of time. And this guy is getting called twice. So now I've identified where my problem is. And I could go ahead and implement something like a cache so that I'm only going to run this query once, for example. And I'm going to save 500 milliseconds off my page load time. Okay. So that was the profiler, and the last thing I wanted to talk about was symbols. So I showed you the debugger, two different debugger tools, the profiler and IntelliTrace. In my demos, everything was just kind of working. I was able to go to the source code, and that all just kind of worked. But they all just worked because I already had all my symbol settings and everything pre-configured, and everything was just available. All those tools require symbol files to be available to work. The symbol files provide a mapping between the binaries that you are analyzing and the source code that produced them. It also provides important information for determining the local variables for a function. So the debugger wants to list out those local variables. If IntelliTrace wants to, it's going to need that information. So symbol files must exactly match the build that you are diagnosing. So if you have symbol files from, two builds ago, and you're trying to diagnose something from three builds ago, even if there was very little change between those two builds, none of these tools are going to be able to use those symbols. It's really easy for your development environment to get out of sync with the production environment. So it's important to know where your symbols are so that you can properly perform these diagnostics. I'll talk a little bit about source indexing. Obviously, you need your source code, right, to solve any of these problems, right? We were, in all those cases, we were diving right back to the source code. So what source indexing does is it embeds a command into the symbol file for each source file indexed. The diagnostic tools in Visual Studio, they can use that command to fetch the source file. And what this gives you is essentially a way to make sure that if you can find your symbol files, you can also find your source files. The binary is what you're diagnosing. It needs to have an exact match to the symbol file, and then the symbol file contains that source command, which allows you to grab the source file. When you do this, Visual Studio in the past has had kind of a lousy user experience because Visual Studio is going to run that command. Well, running a command that's coming from a file is not necessarily something you want to do without the user knowing about it. So we do give you a security warning that allows you to deny that if you want. In the early versions of Visual Studio, there were two buttons on this dialog. You could say run or don't run, that command. That can be kind of inconvenient because one symbol file can have a lot of different source files. And so you don't want to be bothered with that dialog every time. What we've did is in Visual Studio 2012 Update 1, we've added a few more options. So what you can do is you can say, well, I want to always trust commands from this particular symbol file, because I trust that one. And I'm fine with letting it go and fetch source. The other thing that you can do is you can just say, you know what, I know where I'm getting all my symbol files from. They're all from, you know, my company's symbol share or wherever, and I'm just going to trust them, and I just always want to trust source server commands and just never see this dialog again. So that if you get the latest update, you will get this improved user experience. So you can make this process of indexing sources and keeping your symbol files around a lot easier using TFS build. So you can look at the build definition and save a source file. And actually, why don't we just take a look on Visual Studio here. Let's go back to this machine. Stop debugging. Okay, so I'm going to go to my Team Explorer, take a look at builds. Okay, so I have a build definition here. I'm going to edit that build definition, look at the process. Okay. So I have index sources turned on to true. That's all you need to do is flip that flag. Since this is TFS, and TFS, if you're using TFS, TFS will know how to get your sources for you. You just tell it to embed that command, and it knows how to do that already. And then the simplest thing that you can do to keep your symbols in one place is just to put a share here in the path to publish symbols. And so you can make a build just automatically save those symbols for you. There's retention policies for your builds. So, you know, if you have a specific build process for putting something out into production, you're going to want to keep that build forever instead of just keeping like the latest or something, because you're always going to want those symbol files available. And then of course. When you want to use those symbols, all you need to do is enter that same path that you added to your symbol to your TFS right here in Tools Options Symbols. So you just add that My Symbol Path, and then all of the diagnostic tools in Visual Studio will start to pick that up. Okay, so if you want more information about diagnostics, we've started to blog quite a bit about all of these tools. They're all going on the same location, which is the Visual Studio ALM blog. So if you want to follow the latest and greatest, you might have heard me mention that, hey, we've added some features, and this one is in Visual Studio 2012 Update 1. Well, we are continuing to add value in those updates. And so, for that latest information of what's coming, including what's in the latest CTPs, because there's CTPs available for Update 2 right now, you can follow along on that blog there. So the other thing that I wanted to talk about is feature requests. So I'm the PM for the VS Debugger. And it's one of the most used features in all of Visual Studio. Because of that, whenever I'm meeting developers, you know, they love to request features. And I love talking about feature requests, and I love getting them directly from customers because it's the way we best know what we should be doing. So what we have now is we actually have a user voice site, and you can go to that site there. And this provides a way that if you're not at a conference talking to me, you can still request features in a way that we can see them. Additionally, it allows you to vote, so you can find other features that people are requesting within Visual Studio and add your votes to them. So I can tell you that you know, as we're doing our planning for what's coming next in the pipeline, we take that voting extremely seriously. And while I can't promise any specific features that are coming in the next versions of Visual Studio, I can tell you that a lot of the features that have a lot of votes are being worked on right now. So with that, I wanted to switch over to Q&A for a few minutes. So if you have any questions, you know, you can just raise your hand and I can do my best to answer them for you. Question right there. Okay, so the question for the audience was, if you are downloading the IntelliTrace installer, what's the best way to include that in my installer that my customers are running so that it's all compliant with the license agreement? Unfortunately, I think I'll need to ask some marketing guys to help you out with that one. You know, I'm on the engineering side and not really ready to advise on the licensing agreement. But what I can do is I can loop you in with those guys and figure out what we should do there. Yes, over there. Okay, so the question is, with the remote debugger, how do I get that working in Azure? I'm glad you asked that. If you want to run it in Azure, there's actually some special magic that Azure has to help get that working, so you don't actually have to configure the firewall. It's something that maybe we can discuss a little bit more on how to get that. But yeah, I would like to talk more specifically about which types of things you're interested in doing in Azure that way. But in terms of doing the install the traditional way, you would not do that on Azure. And the reason is the main reason is that the firewall is one issue, but the other issue is how do I target that machine specifically and get through the proxy and everything? Are there additional questions? Okay, I'll be around. I'll stick around for a little while if anybody wants to ask me something one-on-one. Thank you very much.